is nowhere. Crow!
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 618. It's me and Jason today, and we are going to cover AIAIO. It's here. It's been here for quite a while. And over the next, I don't know, couple of years, it's going to be changing so much about our world. And as I said, coming into this year early on, I think it was January, maybe early February, by the time we go 12 months from the beginning of this year, we're going to be standing in a very different world. And it's already shaken out to look that way now. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And good afternoon.
I have a message for everyone who lives in the European Union. The EU is trying to force its internet laws on me here in the United States. They have this thing where you have to submit all kinds of personal information to them, which they will then post in public to include things like your home address. And I'm not going to be doing that. I'm not interested in doing that. It is likely that the option I will choose is to no longer serve content on the Apple platform in the European Union to those countries. You should bear in mind, there's a reason I have everything on a private server, and this is that reason. You can always come to crow777radio.com and download the audio or stream the audio right from the website, or you can use other platforms, though I don't know how extensive this thing is. But what's most offensive about it is they try to force you to self-label. And in doing that, you have to determine whether you're a trader or not. I'm not even kidding. They spell it T-R-A-D-E-R. But come on, you want me to tell you I'm a trader? You can see where this is going and why it's being implemented, so that they have full control and they can censor, take things down. They want your banking information. So I just want to make it perfectly clear. I have told them that I am not a trader. If they don't go for that or they find some issue with that, I will no longer serve to European Union countries from the Apple platform. But you can always come to crow777radio.com on a privately held server, which is why I have it, to continue to be a part of this community. So there's all that. Thank you.
All right. On to AI.
So you put together some mega notes for this. We better keep the train on the track to get through it all. Let's open up with Stargate.
Stargate is an AI infrastructure project involving OpenAI, with Sam Altman acting as a central figure. This project is notably supported by President Donald Trump and involves significant investments, with talks of partnership that have been formed by OpenAI, Oracle, and SoftBank. The initial investment of $100 billion is set to be deployed immediately, and the project aims to scale up to $500 billion over 4 years. The project aims to construct data centers and generate the necessary electricity for advancing AI technology. The overarching aim of the project is to push the boundaries of artificial intelligence by developing the world's most advanced AI supercomputer. This would involve creating systems that could handle complex AI tasks that are far beyond current technological capabilities. This could potentially lead to breakthroughs in machine learning, natural language processing, and other AI domains. Along with the announcement of the project, President Trump mentioned using emergency declarations to expedite the construction, particularly for energy infrastructure that would be necessary for the extensive data centers, suggesting that the government's role with Stargate could include streamlining regulatory processes or bypassing the usual bureaucratic delays in order to ensure that the project moves forward swiftly. Ultimately, the project seems to envision a world where AI significantly enhances human life, addressing complex societal challenges from climate change to healthcare by providing intelligent solutions at an unprecedented scale. As of this writing, Stargate has progressed with construction and initial funding. However, it faces skepticism about its ethical leadership, financial viability, and strategic assumptions. Its energy strategy and tech ambitions have been made quite clear, but there are many doubts about its long-term execution and overall impact.
Oh, please. Oh, please. Trying to blunt the sword with that last sentence. In case people haven't noticed, our current administration is dismantling the government. He's doing so for this reason or that reason, anything he can think of to look like a savior. But the truth is, things are changing and they're not going back to the way they were. Everybody knows how I feel about AI, and I think many people have in their mind, oh, Crow, you're just an old guy, you're an old fuddy-duddy, not getting with the new reality. And so I'll explain to you why I think AI is evil. If you break down something to try to determine what it actually is, like the word evil is an example, that doesn't get defined very much. If you think about what AI is doing and what these platforms that currently exist are doing to our lives, they're infringing on our God-given divinity. When you lose free speech, when you lose creativity, when you lose all the freedoms that come with being a human being, to me, that is the definition of evil. And that is precisely what we have seen across social media is control, censorship, deletion of content, subjugating of groups of people who want to talk together. And AI, when it's open and completely released, so there is no doubt to anyone what's running everything, is, in my view, going to be what I just described on steroids. And I don't know, Jason, do you think I'm over the top in the way I view AI? Do you view it similarly or vastly different?
I see it as a tool, but I also see it as something that could very easily get out of control very quickly.
Beyond the reasonable shadow of doubt, and there's more to this. We're going to have generations of young people that grow up never having had to do things like basic math. They're not going to be able to read cursive handwriting unless they teach themselves. They're going to rely on the computer in their pocket. If that is ever taken away or goes down, there's going to be a lot of things that that generation won't be able to handle. They'll have to learn it on the fly. It's going to be doing so many things for us. And I always remember my math class. I don't know if you're old enough. There was a time where if you got caught in school with a calculator, you were in trouble. And then 10 years later, you were required to have a scientific calculator. And then it came to a point where no one's fooling anyone anymore. Everyone's got a calculator and they're doing it instead of memorizing what we used to have to memorize.
I'm old enough that you did not use those calculators in regular school. But the higher math stuff, you had to have a scientific calculator. But most people, unless they were going for that sort of thing, didn't go to those classes.
Right. And the scientific calculator was used a little differently than you might imagine. It was there so you could learn the functions of how to apply it in maybe a job setting or something, not just to do basic math.
So for an update on this, as of March 5th, 2025, the construction has begun on the project's flagship data center in Abilene, Texas. It's a massive 875-acre complex, and this is intended to serve as a central hub for powering the AI systems. So this is happening, and I don't think there's any stopping it at this point because all the people involved are putting forth a lot of money. They don't have the $500 billion yet, but they've got $100 billion, and that's a lot of money to get things going.
It's a bit much to take when they're always screaming climate change and green and don't damage nature. The size alone of some of these places destroys a lot of land. And I think everyone's heard murmurs about the supposed amount of water that gets used by these places. And whenever you have that many electronic devices, of course, you're polluting, aren't you? Unless I don't know something. Anyhow, let's keep moving.
The film Metropolis, which was directed by Fritz Lang and released in the year 1927, holds what is considered significant cultural and historical importance in the context of the concept of artificially intelligent machines being introduced into the mainstream lexicon, as it is the first AI character in a cinematic release. It is regarded as a pioneering science fiction film and is among the first feature-length films of the genre. Filming took place over 17 months in 1925 and 26 at a cost of more than 5 million Reichsmarks, or the equivalent of approximately $20 million, a significant sum for the time. Metropolis is set in a futuristic urban dystopia, a concept that will be heavily used in science fiction until this day. The story follows the attempts of Frieder, who is the wealthy son of the city master, and Maria, who is a saintly figure to the workers, to overcome the vast gulf that separates the classes in their city and bring the workers together with John Friederson, who is the city master. Class conflict was a commonly discussed theme at the time that this film was made. In the film's story, the Maschinenmensch, which means machine human in German, is not just a machine, but an entity with potential for independent action. This shows that there was serious thought given to the potential capabilities and consequences of creating intelligent machines by the film's creators. While the technology depicted in the film is more about robotics, the underlying concepts touch on the essence of what AI would later become, which is machines with autonomy, human-like intelligence, and the capacity for both doing good and causing harm.
So how long has the game we're facing now been going on? This film was made in 1927, and to plunk down that kind of cash is significant. And actually, in my view, at that time, a lot more significant than it is now. It's not so uncommon for us to hear rich people throwing around millions of dollars. Back then, it stood out a lot more. And when you put that kind of cash behind an idea, it's for a reason. And I would point out that in 2001, go ahead and count the ways, the film was inscribed on UNESCO's Memory of the World Register. And I would absolutely associate the AI idea with this, although many of the things I read try to make it more like it's just a regular robot. From my point of view, science fiction became mainstream as a tool to get people to think in a fictitious way about things. Because when you think in a common sense manner and reality is your basis, that's a long ways away from thinking in a fictitious mindset all the time, which we're basically surrounded by. And we've said it so many times, science fiction got no respect for, I don't know, well into my 20s and 30s even. Maybe as the movie The First Blade Runner came out, that was starting to change. And even with that, the first film, I think it's the first to win Best Picture, is 2017's The Shape of Water. Now, I know Lord of the Rings is in the running there for one of the top honors, but I think that's actually classified as fantasy. Apparently, when this film came out, there was a lot of uproar about the communist messaging in it. But at the end of the day, Jason, I know you've seen it. Oh, we didn't even mention that Queen bought the rights to this film, right? The band Queen, for a very cheesy short music video. I understand they bought the rights. I should have looked that up. But where are you at? They try to play this off as if it's just a robot, but I don't see that at all. I see it as artificial intelligence.
Yeah, there's definitely artificial intelligence in this.
Because many of the things I read tried to say, looking forward to a time and coming back to robot. But anyhow.
Queen didn't actually buy the film, but they did get permission to use some scenes.
You know, isn't it interesting, too, though, the whole dystopia thing that is so commonplace now? What was it? Something like, I don't know, I'll take a random guess. Mid-90s, we start to see all these dystopian post-apocalyptic America films. This is 1929. Very dystopian.
Isaac Asimov was a prolific science fiction writer and biochemist whose numerous works have had significant influence on both the genre of science fiction and the field of artificial intelligence. Starting back in 1939, Isaac Asimov wrote or edited over 500 books, which covered a wide range of topics from science fiction to popular science and history. His work in science fiction is what primarily connected him to the theme of artificial intelligence. Isaac Asimov's most famous contribution to the concept of artificial intelligence is the formulation of what he called the Three Laws of Robotics, which he first introduced in his 1942 short story, Runaround. The three laws are as follows. 1. A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. 2. A robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. 3. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws. His laws have been highly influential in shaping how robots and AI are conceptualized in both the world of fiction as well as real-world robotics ethics debates. One of his most famous books, iRobot, that was published in 1950, is a collection of short stories that focuses on robots and their interactions with humans. The stories explore themes of autonomy, robot ethics, and the implications of AI in society. iRobot is where Isaac Asimov fully elaborates on the three laws. The Oxford English Dictionary credits his science fiction writings for introducing into the English language the words robotics, positronic, which is an entirely fictional technology, and psychohistory, the latter of which is used in Asimov's Foundation series.
Kind of interesting how many things in our world start out as fiction. Many of them travel along in the film genre. But for those who remember, Will Smith was in the remake iRobot, is that right?
Yes.
So his character, how he views the tech coming, see how they employ that to try to proffer a point of view, like he's the guy that's out of step when he can see the problems that are coming. But I looked up the three laws. It's kind of interesting. I would urge people to do it. Apparently, there were like 27 variations at one point. They were pulled at one point, and then I guess others went in to rework them. But bear in mind, this is a sci-fi tale out of a little skinny book once upon a time, and look at the impact it's had in the real world.
The 1940s played a pivotal role in laying the conceptual foundations for artificial intelligence. This was done primarily through developments in cybernetics, neural network theory, and the emergence of computing technology. In 1943, Warren McCullough and Walter Pitts published their paper, A Logistical Calculus of Ideas Immanent in Nervous Activity. Warren McCullough, who was a neurophysiologist, and Walter Pitts, a mathematician, published the seminal paper in the Bulletin of Mathematical Biophysics. In it, they proposed a model of artificial neurons that could perform logical operations, which would essentially create a mathematical model of brain function. This work was foundational for binary logic. It introduced the idea that neurons could be modeled to perform logical functions, akin to binary computation, which is zero or one, or on or off. They suggested that complex behaviors could arise from networks of these simple neuron-like units, being proposed well before modern neural network architectures.
So people should get, if you've studied at all, spiritual histories from different cultures around the world, in every one of them that's a significant culture, you will find your masters, your yogis, your saints. And the things that these people are said to be able to accomplish is beyond magical in many cases. Enough so that most people would probably dismiss it, except it reoccurs over time, over culture, places that seemingly had no contact, the amazing things that the human can do, the divinity within a human and the spiritual levels with our bodies intact the way they are can rise to. This whole thing is a knockoff of that. It's what I always call Fugazi. It's a cheap imitation copy. And every time we start reading these things, they can't just make a machine. They've got to get their psychoanalyst in there and start to cross it over to brain function. And you see where I'm going here, Jason. But to me, this is another underscoring of why this is all very dark. Because at the end of the day, it does and it will infringe on your God-given body, which is already capable of ascending to Lord only knows what spiritual heights. And this is meant to block that.
Conrad Zuse, who lived from 1910 to 1995, was a German civil engineer, inventor, and computer pioneer who was widely recognized for his groundbreaking work in the development of the first programmable computers that were electromechanical in nature. This gave Nazi Germany access to such technology, as well as several other types of computing technology during World War II, which, while not as advanced as modern computers, were quite significant and extremely useful for their time. Conrad Zuse made four versions of his electromechanical computers, beginning with the Z1 in 1938. This was the first freely programmable computer, being entirely mechanical and used mechanical relays, but was not fully functional. However, the Z1 laid the groundwork for the Z2 that came along in 1940. The Z2 was an improvement over the Z1, using electromechanical relays as opposed to purely mechanical parts, but had too many practical issues and still wasn't made fully operational due to the disruptions of World War II. The Z3 came in 1941, which is recognized as the world's first working, programmable, fully automatic digital computer, which used 2,600 relays. It was considered Turing complete, which means a system that can solve any computational problem if it is given enough time and memory resources. It was also capable of performing floating point arithmetic. The Z3 was destroyed in an Allied bombing raid in 1943. The Z4 was the last version made in 1945, which is the only Zeus machine that survived World War II. This one was an electromechanical computer with a more robust design. Once the war was over, Zeus continued in this field with many successes, with the Z4 arguably becoming the first commercial digital computer when it was completed in 1950. It was also the first commercially available computer.
I mean, an important computer guy I've never heard of, and I think he lived into the 90s, if I remember correctly from the lookup I did, and he's a Zeus to boot.
He died in 1995.
Yeah, it's interesting that his name is Zeus, but I mean, when you start laying down dates like 1941, talking about a fully automatic digital computer, and then go on to say that can solve any computational problem if it is given enough time and memory resources, that kind of gives you a new window into how long this has been going on and probably what's been available that we're not even aware of.
Besides the multiple iterations of the Z machines, Nazi Germany made extensive use of IBM's punch card technology through IBM's German subsidiary company, Dehumag. This technology was considered pivotal for Germany's administrative tasks, with an example being the 1933 and 1939 censuses that categorized and tracked populations. Once they were begun in Poland and other countries after 1939, every concentration camp had what was called a Hollerith department, which used punch cards to track the camp's inmates. This included births, deaths, and transfers with what is considered chilling efficiency, especially for the time. The machines also help manage logistical operations, from train schedules to military supply chains, again being considered quite efficient. Lastly, Nazi Germany utilized two different electromechanical cipher machines, Enigma and Lorenz, that were used for encrypting military communications. Enigma is the more well-known one, which was a three-wheel machine that was used for air, land, and sea travel. The Lorenz was a 12-wheel machine that was considerably more advanced and complex, and was also more secure than Enigma. Lorenz was used by Adolf Hitler, his high command, and top generals for transmitting the highest grade of intelligence messages. Both machines would be cracked at Bletchley Park during World War II, which contributed greatly to the Allied war effort.
So right out of the gate, you know, you hear the name Enigma. For some reason, there were two, but we've all heard of the Enigma. And I would suggest to you, probably because of the Bond movie, among other movies. And anytime a thing makes the movies like that, it's a foregone conclusion that they're pushing a point of view. But let's go back here. So they have this punch card technology. They have computers that can do things. And they're doing what you might expect, right? They're doing train stations and ticketing and things like this. But where does it go way back then? They're going to track inmates, human beings, including births, deaths, transfer. You see how it always goes to infringe on the divinity of human beings.
In 1948, Norbert Wiener, an American mathematician, philosopher, and cyberneticist who held an academic post at MIT from 1919 until 1960, releases his book, Cybernetics, or Control and Communication in the Animal and the Machine, which introduced the term cybernetics, a word that comes from the Greek word for steersman or governor. Cybernetics dealt with the study of control and communication in both living organisms and machines, providing a theoretical framework for feedback systems. Wiener emphasized feedback mechanisms as fundamental to control systems, an idea that is central to both biological systems and machine automation. Cybernetics linked fields like biology, engineering, mathematics, and psychology. This fostered an environment where AI could later flourish. Interestingly, Wiener was also concerned with how humans interact with machines, including ethical implications, which he would discuss in his later works.
Yeah, he was clearly worried about ethical concerns when he coins a term, and in the title, cybernetics, followed by a colon, or the control of communication in the animal and machine. It's already dark, dude. Don't come talking to us about ethics, Mr. Wiener. Maybe you should stick to hot dogs and Franks. But when you see how far back we are here, and then you reference movies that were just thrown in our faces recently, so popular, I think it's Captain America Civil War. I can't remember. I can't keep them straight. The Austrian or the German dude working with the Red Skull came up with a algorithm or some math way, way back before they had computers that demonstrated what could be done. And then when they had the computers to back it up, what did he say? The 21st century is an open book. And look what we're looking at here. We're back in the very early 1900s. What was an algorithm like that or a math like that already put together at the turn of the century? I'm just asking.
Alan Turing, who lived from 1912 to 1954, was a British mathematician, computer scientist, logician, and cryptanalyst whose work was foundational to the development of computer science, theoretical computation, and because of these significant accomplishments, would be highly influential for later work on artificial intelligence. He was one of the key people to crack the Enigma code at Bletchley Park during World War II. Turing introduced the concept of the Turing machine in his paper On Computable Numbers with an application to the Eichstein-Dunsch problem, which was a theoretical device that was capable of computing any computable sequence if it was given the right program. The Turing machine laid the theoretical groundwork for modern computing and the notion of algorithmic computation, which is central to AI programming.
So you will almost never catch me and my wife watching modern films, and I purposely watched the one about Alan Turing. The movie's called The Imitation Game, and I sat down to watch it because of what it's about. And I had to force myself to sit and watch to the end because it is the most agenda-ridden programming film. And, you know, to be fair, that's why we don't watch the modern ones, because it's what they are. But it was almost insulting. This was around the time when the whole woke thing was being jammed down everyone's throat. And the same old things cropped up here. It became less about what he supposedly did and more about gender and autism, if that's even the right word to apply, because I don't remember the movie that well. But whenever you see a topic like this put into a film with A-list actors, you know that they're pushing a point of view. And I just think it's critical to keep these things in mind. I don't know if you saw the film, Jason, did you?
I did, and it's fairly accurate. They definitely took some liberties with some of it, of course, and you are right about the whole wokey woke thing.
It just agenda-ridden. See, I'm a little bit critical that way. Once that happens more than once, I can't fake like I'm enjoying the movie anymore. It's just glaring to me, and it destroys any probability of a storyline making a difference for me anyhow.
In Alan Turing's paper, Computing Machinery and Intelligence, he proposed the Turing test, which was originally called the imitation game, as a criterion for machine intelligence, with the test positing that if a machine can engage in a conversation with a human evaluator in such a way that the evaluator cannot reliably tell if they are speaking to a machine or another human, then the machine can be said to think. This concept has had significant influence on AI research by providing a benchmark for machine intelligence, focusing on language interaction, understanding, and generation. It has driven the development of natural language processing, NLP, chatbots, and conversational AI, which is now a reality. Turing had speculated about the possibility of machines learning and thinking like humans. In his 1950 paper, he not only introduced the Turing test, but also discussed how machines might learn, suggesting programs could evolve or improve with experience. This appears to have been correct, because this is what exists with modern machine learning. Turing worked on the development of the first British computers, like the Automatic Computing Engine, ACE, and explored programming concepts. He also wrote one of the earliest chess-playing programs, though it was, unfortunately, never implemented during his lifetime. But it showed early interest in AI applications. Alan Turing's work was critical during World War II at Bletchley Park on decrypting the German Enigma code, which involved designing electromechanical machines for code-breaking. This can be seen as an early form of applying computational thinking to solving complex problems, which is a precursor to AI's problem-solving capabilities. He had also employed methods in code breaking that involved machine logic, pattern recognition, and statistical analysis, all of which are critical in AI, particularly in areas like machine learning and data analysis.
You know, to me, I get the hairs on the back of my neck when I see it described in this kind of no-nonsense way that I detect is pushing a point of view, trying to convince me to think about AI and what they're doing here in a certain way. The first thing I notice is the title, Imitation Game, right? So they're going to imitate where truth resides in nature, the closest to perfection we have here. So right out of the gate, they're imitating something, but then they turn around with the definition of how will we know when this thing is sentient? And they say, well, when you're talking to it and you can't tell the difference anymore, someone wouldn't be able to say that's obviously a machine. And I don't really agree with that as the dividing line, but what I agree with or don't isn't the point. I think that with AI, what it's actually connected to was here and has been here. And I think that what AI is doing is tapping into something as opposed to inventing something. And we're already starting to see people asking AI itself these types of questions. And I would urge people to go listen to the responses they get. And I have been very critical of Grok and what it's connected to. I don't talk about it a lot. I won't, but it's basically a demon.
So just out of curiosity, I asked Grok 3, which is the current iteration of the AI chatbot for the X platform, if it could pass the Turing test. And it said that depends upon how you want to look at it. And while the thing is very much conversational, you can tell that it's a computer. So to a point, I guess if you were just kind of chatting back and forth and it was told not to give up that it was a computer, it might actually pass the Turing test, no problem, other than the fact that it takes a few moments to respond depending upon what it is you ask it. Obviously, if you ask something like the kinds of questions I'll ask things, it takes longer for it to answer because it's got to go digging for answers. But if you're just chit-chatting with it, it'll spit it out almost instantaneously. So it could technically be said to be passing the Turing test at this point, but not truly. As the AI and I discussed, in fact, if you want to consider that a true AI, it really depends upon how you want to look at it. And the Turing test is kind of not really the way you'd look at it in the 21st century as they were looking at it way back when in the mid 20th century.
And we should keep in mind that any so-called AI that's available to the masses is kindergarten handicapped, I think I would call it, nowhere near what can be done. But again, so you're telling me if I walk into a room, I talk to a machine and it's convincing enough that I'm not sure whether there's a human behind the screen or a machine, then it's sentient? Sorry, not doing it. There's so much complexity in being a being and interacting. Like, let's talk about even something as simple as emotion. You know, are we anywhere close to a machine being able to deal with accurately human emotion? But we need to keep this on the path, Jason.
The Day the Earth Stood Still is considered a classic science fiction film that was released in 1951 and was directed by Robert Wise. It is based on a 1940 short story titled Farewell to the Master, written by Harry Bates. The plot of the film centers on an alien visitor who was named Klaatu. He arrives on Earth in a flying saucer and is accompanied by a powerful robot named Gort. Klaatu's mission is to deliver a critical message to humanity. Earth must abandon its violent ways and live in peace, or it will face destruction by an interplanetary federation that is said to use advanced technology to maintain order. The robot Gort is an artificially intelligent machine and is a large humanoid robot and is a key element of the story, as he serves as the companion and enforcer of the alien visitor Klaatu. Gort is an 8-foot-tall metallic robot with a sleek, featureless design, with the exception of a visor-like opening across its face that glows when activated. Gort accompanies Klaatu, the extraterrestrial emissary who arrives on Earth to deliver a message of peace, as well as a warning to humanity about its destructive tendencies, especially in regard to nuclear weapons. Gort is portrayed as a silent and imposing figure who exudes an aura of immense power and mystery. This character very much contributed to making the movie become the classic that it is considered.
Okay, and it is considered a classic. Everyone should know it was redone, but I think Keanu Reeves, I don't think that one was nearly as popular. But let's start here. What if nuclear weapons don't exist as described? If that was true, then what does that say about this movie? Think about it for a minute. That would make this a complete social engineering, programming, agenda-ridden film that is seeking to change the way you think about things. But there's more. Now, the name Gort, this is interesting. It's not really important. I think Gort might have been meant to mean genetically organized robotic technology, but it's possible that came along later and was passed off as older. Not sure, but that's not the main point. The main point is, even if you throw away the nuclear idea that I just put forward, which is a critical idea, they used this movie in a very clever way. This film is an allegory for the arrival of Christ with the new covenant of God. Very cleverly placed in a sci-fi film, so very few people probably ever picked up on it. As a matter of fact, I'm imagining as I say this, many people are probably rolling their eyes, going, no way. There's clues all over the place. If you take the storyline where Klaatu is resurrected, there's so much. Even the name he chooses, he becomes Mr. Carpenter. One of the main players is an actress named Helen. She could be allegorized with Mary Magdalene. And so that on itself is interesting, but why? And I'll tell you why. Because sci-fi wasn't, I think this was meant to be a B movie, and it ended up being much more popular than they realized. But why would they do something like this? And it's because of the mindset of the moviegoers of the time. This was an audience back then that lined up in record numbers to see The Robe, Christian, 1942, Ben-Hur, Christian, 1959, David and Bathsheba, 1951, Samson and Delilah, 1949, and of course, the Ten Commandments in 56. So you can see where the mindset of America was back then. And then once you know that, and you go back and look at The Day the Earth Stood Still, you can see why they did what they did.
The birth of AI could be considered to take place in the 1950s, with the term artificial intelligence being officially coined in 1956 by John McCarthy at the Dartmouth Summer Research Project on Artificial Intelligence. This conference brought together researchers like Marvin Minsky, Nathaniel Rochester, and Claude Shannon to explore ideas about machine intelligence. The log theorist, developed in 1956 by Alan Newell and Herbert A. Simon, was one of the first AI programs. It was designed to mimic human problem solving in logical proofs. It was presented at the Dartmouth Conference and was capable of proving theorems in Whitehead and Russell's Principia Mathematica. Also by Newell and Simon, the General Problem Solver from 1957 aimed to solve a broader class of problems by applying means-ends analysis, a strategy that is still used in AI today for problem solving.
All the way back in the 50s, they're saying things like, and they're coining terms, that's how old it is, they're coining the term artificial intelligence, and they're going to explore ideas about machine intelligence. Machines don't have intelligence. Machines will never have intelligence, at least not as a one-to-one, to be creation-created beings. And that is a fact. And yet, from the gate, from the opening, there's this muddling of the waters, this pouring the oil into the milk with how they title things and how they're already thinking about things. But I'm going to stop there because we got so many to get through. Go ahead, Jason.
In 1958, John McCarthy invented Lisp, or list processing, which is one of the oldest high-level programming languages that is still in use and was specifically designed for AI research. Lisp's flexibility made it particularly suited for symbolic computation, which was central to early work in artificial intelligence. In the mid-1950s and demonstrated in 1956, Arthur Samuel developed a checkers program, which is often cited as one of the earliest programs to demonstrate machine learning, as it could improve its performance over time by playing against itself or human opponents. Marvin Minsky, who is considered one of the founders of AI, was interested in understanding and automating human-level reasoning. His work on the geometric theorem prover, which was developed in 1957, was part of his broader research into how machines could solve complex problems. The geometric theorem prover was one of the early demonstrations that computers could perform tasks that were traditionally thought of as to require human intelligence, specifically in the domain of formal reasoning. Also in 1957, Frank Rosenblatt's work on the perceptron at Cornell Aeronautical Laboratory introduced one of the first attempts at artificial neural networks. It was quite a simple version by today's standards, but it laid the groundwork for future developments in neural networks and deep learning. There was considerable optimism about the potential of AI in the 1950s that came with predictions that machines would soon match or exceed human intelligence in various tasks. These predictions were terribly incorrect, but the groundwork that was laid down in the 1950s, however, would be used to build from and is considered crucial for later advancements.
I mean, if you look carefully, you can detect the mindset of the people going at this in these historical accounts we're being told about here in the 50s. An artificial neural network. It's almost like in that group of individuals, they don't look at the human body in the way that it always has been. They look at it as like a machine that can be taken apart or hacked into and these kinds of things. And it's just, it's perverse when you look at it, but it's all plausibly deniable, as so many of the things are these days. The irony is not lost on me that they named the initial programming language Lisp, which is basically a speech impediment. And then there's the fact that this is where they're beginning to realize they can train up their algorithms better by having it play itself or opponents. And I might not get this 100% right, but there are older episodes that you could go back to get it exactly right. The first book covering AI in depth was Zuboff, written by Zuboff. And it was a big, thick book that I read, but in it, she described having access into many boardrooms, how they were trying to get a machine to beat checkers, and they did it, chess. And, you know, everyone saw that play out on the world stage. After a bit of time, they did it. But then they went for the Asian game Go, which is way more possibilities, and they couldn't do it. Finally, someone got the idea to remove human input. And I think the number was like within 72 hours, this thing they'd been trying to crack for so long, the machine on its own cracked it. So it goes to show you they were already thinking about training things in that way in the 50s.
The book you're referring to is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff that was released in 2019.
Yeah, I got it the year it came out. It's a big, fat, thick book. And I would say nearly everything in there from my point of view was correct. But my beef with it was that it didn't go nearly far enough. And from the first chapter to the last, it is repeatedly said, this could be dangerous. This might go too far. And repeatedly people said, yeah, you're probably right. And then they kept going.
In 1956, the major motion picture Forbidden Planet is released and is considered one of the great landmark science fiction films of the 1950s. It was released by MGM at a cost of $1.9 million. Forbidden Planet pioneered several aspects of science fiction cinema. It was the first science fiction film that had a story that depicted humans traveling in a man-made, faster-than-light starship, as well as being the first to be set entirely on a planet that is orbiting another star that is far away from the Earth and its solar system. Of particular interest is the friendly Robbie the Robot character, who is one of the first robots in film that was more than just a mechanical tin can on legs. Robbie appears to be an artificially intelligent machine and displays a distinct personality, making him a supporting character in the film. Robbie the Robot was a very expensive prop to make, especially at this time, with a cost of approximately $125,000, which represented almost 7% of the film's $1.9 million budget.
Boy, that's a big expense to decide to make. This is an important film, and it's important on a lot of levels, primarily because of what it is. It is literally, as far as I know, the first, I guess we could say, mega budget film in the sci-fi genre. For years, I recognized that this was an important film, but it wasn't until very, very recently that I put it all together. I typically watch this film every few years, if it comes around. Here's the thing. When they get to the planet, there's an ancient race that had been there that left all this tech. That tech is AI. These machines had been running for however many hundred millennium and repairing themselves. That's AI. Morbius, the man who has control of this, finds a brain booster that can kill human beings. He manages to boost his brain up, and he creates Robbie, who is also AI, just far lesser version. But there's a monster on the planet, and here's where they give away what I consider to be the truth about the most powerful forms of AI that we will never be able to attach our keyboard to. After using the brain boost, the monster would manifest, leveraging off his subconscious. In other words, you've got all this AI, but for it to go out and interact and wreak havoc or do whatever it's going to do, it needed a living mind. And I think that's exactly what's going on with AI at the highest levels. And I think that's why there's so much effort to convince you that it's all just a machine. And I will say again, is the human brain mind, or is it just the hardware that taps into the mind? You can kind of see where I'm going here. But if you ever get a chance to catch this film, you should. It's supposedly related to a film released, or the story, The Tempest, from 1611. There are plot crossovers that are analogous. Way back then, it did get nominated for an Academy Award. I don't think it won. So this is supposedly taking place in the 23rd century. And they go to the distant planet Altair, that's a real star name, to determine the fate of a ship called Bellerophon. And what you should know is that's pulled from Greek myth. That's the son of Poseidon and Eurynome, I think is the way you say it. Setting all that aside, you've got to realize that all the Greek myth and everything we're told about that is a similar thing as the AI to me. They're trying to convince you that these ridiculous hokey people that lived back then were convinced that there were gods like Zeus. And I don't buy that. The stories were a personification so that they could illustrate in stories what they wanted to communicate. What they actually were luminaries and energies in nature. Zeus, as an example, was a planet you could point at. And I think that's a far cry from the way we're being told to think about what Greek myth is. But here it is again. All the way back in the first big budget sci-fi, they're crossing over ship names, and it's a ship, right? Like on the ocean, the water idea, and it is named after characters in Greek mythology. Important ones, by the way. You could look up the story of Bellerophon, I guess it is.
All right, well, that brings us to the top of hour one. When we come back, we're going to get into another Isaac Asimov contribution.
All right, we're going to take a short break. But until then, Hour One is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums and comment sections. They can create top-level ideas. They can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon that has 10 awards. That film covers all my old telescope work, all the lunar waves, UFOs, weird things about the moon, and the first capture in, I think, 2015 of the so-called second sun, which people are starting to take an interest in. Also, the still images I have taken with my hydrogen alpha scope, which I have left evidence in many of them of the second sun, are available for purchase on the website as well. With that, we'll see you in a few minutes, and I hope to see you logged in as a member for hour two. I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.